Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and I'm coming to you again today from our friends up in Boston at partner station WGBH. Boston, which was the setting for a remarkable film, Mystic River, you may remember, back in 2003. It was all about how a horrible case of police sexual abuse destroyed lives and almost derailed a murder investigation. Sean Penn was in the movie, Kevin Bacon, Tim Robbins. We begin this hour looking at a three-part real-life investigation of police misconduct being reported this week by the Associated Press that shows a nationwide pattern of police sexual misconduct. Approximately 1,000 officers across 41 states examined have had their badges stripped during a period from 2009 to 2014 for offenses like rape, sexual assault, and other crimes. But it's just the smallest window on a problem that points up how suspects can become victims and officers violent perpetrators, a victimization that parallels the police brutality cases of Eric Garner, killed in July of last year, the case of Michael Brown, who died in Ferguson, Missouri, and the deaths of Walter Scott and Freddie Gray in 2015. How this sexual abuse happens and is kept hidden within a closed culture of law enforcement that varies widely across the nation is the result of work by Noman Merchant, Associated Press reporter who led the investigation alongside Matt Sadensky. Noman joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What kinds of cases did you look at that seem to suggest that there is a culture of nondisclosure here, which may be much more widespread than we've thought up until now?
We found a number of cases in which an officer had been accused of sexual assault in one police department or sexual misconduct in one department, and through a variety of different ways or oversights moved to another department. We found a case out of Grand Junction, Colorado, where a police officer had been accused of sexual assault at his previous employer, but that accusation didn't come forward until he had already been hired by another department. And he eventually ended up being accused of sexual assault at that second employer, and that's when previous allegations came to light. He eventually was accused of three allegations and ended up committing suicide. And that was just one example of what police chiefs I interviewed talked about as this culture of nondisclosure. In the case of that Colorado officer, the police chief in Grand Junction, Colorado, told me that he has started to ask all officers applying to his department to allow any sort of disclosure from their previous employers, any material, any paperwork, to be provided to his hiring department. And if they refuse to do that, that's a major red flag and they won't consider them for employment any longer. So this is something that police chiefs both acknowledge and are trying to fix.
Noman, I remember the reporting and did a bunch of it myself of the problems within the Catholic Church and the Vatican response and the church hierarchical response. And in that particular instance, there was this tension over handling it internally versus reporting it out and having law enforcement deal with it. It sounds like some of the internal, external, non-disclosure issues are eerily similar to what went on within the Catholic Church. Would you say that's the case?
I would say, speaking specifically to law enforcement, like any major institution, there's a certain amount of we can take care of our own. But I think, by and large, one major difference is that it's so decentralized in the United States. Local and state law enforcement agencies have a lot of autonomy and don't really respond in great detail to a federal agency when it comes to police misconduct or reporting data. And so that sort of thing happens at a local level, and it's sort of a case-by-case basis. I think it's tough to make a broad statement.
How would you say the power relationship of police officers makes them more inclined or makes victims more vulnerable to misconduct of this kind? Any commentary on that? Any suggestion that this is a dangerous situation to begin with sometimes?
This is something that the International Association of Chiefs of Police actually identified in a 2011 report, where they talked about the culture of law enforcement potentially being a place where a predator could operate. You know, officers, according to this report, operate without a lot of immediate close supervision. They operate, in many cases, at night in communities where there are a lot of people who've had contacts with law enforcement before, and their stories may not necessarily be believed. A lot of the victims in these cases that we found have had contact with law enforcement before. They have arrests on their records. They have convictions. Some of them struggle with drug addiction before, during, and after an alleged attack. And in many cases, these are the people that law enforcement and sort of society's institutions of safeguard are there to protect. And that didn't happen in a lot of their cases.
So you're describing transactions, and I use that word so guardedly, like an officer who says, one more strike and you're going up the river, and if you want to prevent that, do A, B, or C, or I can call somebody and have you deported tomorrow kind of thing. Are these the scenarios that you find in your reporting?
Yeah, there are a lot of instances of officers who pulled over somebody in a traffic stop, and whether or not there was some sort of illegal activity, a DUI potentially or something like that, an officer might have said, do this or you're going to jail. And I think one of the other things that's worth keeping in mind is there were a number of cases in prisons and jails where prison guards and sheriff's deputies protecting jails would say to an inmate, do this or there's going to be some sort of punishment. And really, an inmate is not really in a position to consent to that type of activity.
This 1,000 number that you talked about, in 41 states, 1,000 officers had their badges stripped from 2009 to 2014. This is really perhaps the biggest headline here. That number might seem small, but really it's because of the pattern of state-to-state approaches to this that vary very radically across the nation. Can you describe how that works or doesn't?
Yeah. Decertification is, in many cases, sort of a last resort. In many cases, you need to have been convicted of a crime to face a decertification. And we found that states vary greatly on how they decertify officers or when they decertify officers. Some states that have more than 1,000 officers decertified for all types of misconduct over a six-year period don't necessarily have worse officers than a state that didn't decertify anybody. It's just a matter of how active police departments and sheriff's offices are in reporting misconduct and state agencies are in taking action on that misconduct. We found that there were six states that don't decertify for misconduct. They include some of the biggest states in the United States. And we also found that among the states that do decertify, some just didn't give us records, and some gave us very few records or didn't give us a lot of material to work with to research why they had decertified these officers.
Finally, these are crimes. If officers commit crimes, it would seem like it would be relatively simple to convict them of crimes. And in that case, they're not officers. They're off the street. You found that's not the case at all?
Well, I'd say there's a couple of things to that. The first thing is that there are things that an officer can do in the realm of misconduct that don't necessarily lead to a criminal charge for whatever reason. The other thing is that for many reasons that advocates for sexual assault victims can talk about more eloquently, you know, an allegation may not lead to a prosecution.
Noman Merchant is Associated Press reporter who led this investigation of law enforcement around the United States alongside his colleague, Matt Sadensky. Noman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A police voice now on this issue. Norm Stamper was Seattle's police chief from 1994 to 2000. Norm Stamper, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you.
So how familiar is something like this to you in your experience? We should point out that you're the author of a book, Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing. Does this sound familiar to you?
It sounds depressingly familiar. One chapter in that book is entitled Sexual Predators in Uniform. And it's safe to say that no jurisdiction anywhere in this country, police jurisdiction, has been free of this kind of history.
How are officers who listen to this segment, if they do, how are they going to react to this? Oh, here we go again. The media is trashing the police and exaggerating something that's not as big of a problem as the media thinks it is.
Well, that reaction is to be expected. It would also be an unfortunate reaction. This kind of exposure, I think, is critical to the kinds of reforms that are necessary in law enforcement. One of the biggest problems associated with sexual predators in uniform is a lack of supervision, a lack of peer pressure.
Can you comment on the notion that the power position of officers creates a vulnerability and the culture of non-disclosure is a real obstacle of dealing with this? And how did that affect you dealing with this in your own department?
Well, both of those issues are relevant. Both of those issues are terribly important. If there is an attitude bred by the culture that nobody from the outside can really understand the pressures, the organizational and occupational pressures that are associated with police work today. But in point of fact, there are 18,000 police departments in this country, and each and every one of them is different from all the others. But they all have one thing in common, and that is that there are temptations that exist in police work. There are tendencies among the population of police officers that are very discernible and are very predictable, and that makes it much easier for us to deal with this issue.
How did you handle it?
By insisting as a non-negotiable expectation that if you want to be a police officer in this city, whatever city that might happen to be, I was a police officer in San Diego for 28 years, left there as the number two guy. And in both those agencies, San Diego and Seattle, with some degree of regularity, we dealt with an individual officer accused of sexual violence on the job. And we took the view that if you want to be a police officer in this city, you absolutely will not engage in any kind of dating behavior, any kind of overtures toward the men or women you stop on the job. And you had better recognize that if you attempt to trade freedom for sexual gratification, you're out of here. You're toast.
Do you support a uniform or more aggressive reporting and decertification procedures around the United States to create more uniformity?
Absolutely. That's one of the things that needs to happen. Certification, I think, needs to be a national proposition so that nobody can go from one department to another and engage in the same behavior that may have gotten him fired in that previous organization.
Norm Stamper is a former Seattle police chief from 94 to 2000, author of Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing, and a forthcoming book on fixing issues within the police force. He joined us from Orcas Island off Washington State. Norm Stamper, thanks for talking with us from paradise there.
My pleasure.
Last year's Ebola outbreak killed more than 11,000 people in West Africa. But actually, that's not quite right. The virus may have pulled the trigger, but the victims were set up for the kill by flawed communication and traditional practices that enabled spread of the virus, as well as shame and fear that prevented quick action. The next killer virus may be inevitable, but changing the ways in which humans respond is an innovation and design project already underway. WGBH's partnership with the Ground Truth Project and Nova Next has produced a series called Next Outbreak, with reporting on how the latest communications technology and smarter data collection can more quickly detect and track emerging infectious diseases, fatal or not. A tool called HealthMap does exactly that. Please welcome Dr. John Brownstein, Chief Innovation Officer at Boston Children's Hospital and co-founder of HealthMap. Dr. Brownstein, welcome.
Thank you. Well, thanks. For
also with me is Maya Majumdar, a research fellow at HealthMap and a graduate student at MIT. Welcome, Maya.
Thank you.
Now, this is about strategy and tactics, it seems. What I want to do is talk about the old strategy that really is associated with the way we've traditionally done things. Here's Dr. Anita Berry, director of the Infectious Disease Bureau at the Boston Public Health Department.
We work with partners, individual healthcare providers, laboratories, hospitals, community members, because they're really like the night watchmen, right? They're the ones who are going to give us that information about what might be going on so we can go out and investigate.
Dr. Brownstein, that sounds like a responsible approach, but I'm wondering if it's a bit outmoded or doesn't take advantage of what's available today.
Yes, absolutely. So traditional public health is really slowed down by the communication process. People get sick, they're seen by healthcare providers, they get laboratory confirmed. Information about illness flows up the channels towards state and local public health, national governments, then to places like the WHO. Each one of those stages can take days, weeks, even months. And that's the problem if you're thinking about a virus that could spread around the world in a matter of days. So we really think about the communication channels that unwind that hierarchical flow of information and make everyone a stakeholder when it comes to data about outbreaks, including consumers.
To both of you, how does HealthMap change or maybe reinforce, I don't know, the age-old, centuries-old strategy of you get the information, you mobilize some quarantine and wall off a community and shut down the disease that way? Are we continuing with that or are we fundamentally changing that? Dr. Brownstein, you go first.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea is, of course, there are a suite of different tools that public health has as its disposal. What we're trying to do is think about how to communicate and empower individuals to really understand what the risks are, what the true information is about a disease event, and what they can do to protect themselves and their families. It's all about trying to demystify outbreaks and bring people to a better knowledge. Just like they might care about the weather, we're trying to get people to care about the infectious diseases around them and really think a lot about interventions, about vaccination, the kind of just basic public health principles that we all know are so proven.
Give them apps that give them awareness of what's going on around them as opposed to put them in dark rooms and close the door.
If that can be the first step before we have to go to those kind of measures, absolutely. The idea is let's educate people first. Let's improve vaccination rates. Let's make people understand that just basic hygiene can be an extraordinarily important tool to prevent the spread of disease.
What kind of apps work and that you and Dr. Brownstein have designed and tried to implement?
So I think that John likes to say that HealthMap as an organization and some of the products that we develop is really intended to bring the public back into public health. And one of the things that I work on, at least, is basically producing some education tools that actually go straight onto the HealthMap website and can also be accessed via mobile. And HealthMap actually has a number of apps on mobile as well that make it easier for the public to access these sorts of information.
The names of the apps? I mean, it's sort of like Here's How Not to Die, probably not a good name.
Right. But John, do you want to go through
So those? We have an app called Outbreaks Near Me that allows people to know about what disease outbreaks are happening in their neighborhood. Flu Near You is an app that people self-report on symptoms. Vaccine Finder, which is actually a tool that allows people to know what vaccines are available to them in their community. And in fact, even Uber. We worked closely with Uber last year where we actually put nurses in Uber cars and delivered vaccine to people because the closest vaccine location might still be, you know, only a block away for people, but no, people are still hesitant to go and just get it done. So we put nurses in Uber cars and sent vaccines to individuals, and the results were amazing.
Are you more, Maya, or less fearful or concerned or worried about the next outbreak because of these tools?
So I would say that it all depends, again, on context. And the reason that I say that is one of the limitations to digital disease detection is that it does require a tremendous amount of internet penetration, which is terrific for a country like the United States, right? So I think when the next swine flu hits the U.S., I think that we might be better equipped, indeed, because HealthMap does an excellent job of spreading information about how the public can actually take care of their own health, whether it be vaccinating themselves or actually employing social distancing on their own, understanding the importance of washing your hands and coughing into the crook of your arm as opposed to your hand. But when it comes to emerging infectious pathogens, especially in developing countries, I think that we're on the right path, and internet penetration and the increased amount of internet penetration is definitely helping along the way. But without internet penetration, it's a lot harder to communicate these good education tools to a larger populace.
So you might say the cell phone pandemic is ahead of the pathogen pandemic, and that's going to help you out.
Yes, exactly.
Well, HealthMap can be seen at our website, thetakeaway.org. Dr. John Braunstein is Chief Innovation Officer at Boston Children's Hospital and co-founder of HealthMap. Maya Majumdar is a research fellow at HealthMap and a graduate student at MIT. It makes me feel good that you guys are on the case here. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
He was a mathematician who changed the world, but Iraqi exile and political activist Ahmed Chalabi was no Alan Turing. Chalabi, who died of a heart attack this week at his home in Baghdad, was a voice who led the call for an invasion of Iraq after 9/11, who had been influencing the U.S. government to take out Saddam Hussein for years. To some, Ahmed Chalabi was the man who sold the war to the White House, the Pentagon, and the American people. Here he is on the PBS WGBH program Frontline back in 2003.
You have strong evidence that there's links between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein.
U.S.
Where are these? Where is this evidence, though?
In U.S. hands.
And that is a document that you could show us.
I've seen it, but I don't have it in my possession. I could show it to you, I think.
Chalabi was born in Iraq and went from a career in mathematics to finance, to being a man who made a mission out of toppling Saddam Hussein, a voice of a loud opposition who was loudest behind the scenes in the corridors of power where it mattered most. His daughter Tamara, who spoke on this program in 2011, remembered that his voice was loud about his plans for Iraq from the time she was a little girl.
I grew up in a household from a very early age that was absolutely obsessed with Saddam Hussein and his dictatorship and wanting to get rid of it and fighting it, and it wasn't just my father. So witnessing history unfold was very dramatic and out of control.
Indeed.
On many instances.
Tamara Chalabi's father, Ahmed, was often talked about as a possible successor to Saddam Hussein in the event of a war in Iraq. But when things didn't go as planned, his role suddenly changed.
We are sorry for every American life that is lost in Iraq. And I regret every loss of American lives that happened in Iraq subsequent to the end of fighting with Saddam. As for the fact that I deliberately misled the American government, this is an urban myth.
But it's no myth that Chalabi supplied questionable intelligence against Saddam Hussein, and especially after 9/11, to very sympathetic American officials for decades. He was never remorseful about his role in encouraging a U.S. invasion, but he also called himself a bit player, as did U.S. officials, after the war went badly.
I don't remember anybody walking into my office saying, Chalabi says this is the way it's going to be in Iraq. Chalabi? My meetings with him were very brief. I mean, I think I met with him at the State of the Union, and just kind of working through the rope line, and he might have come with a group of leaders. But I haven't had any extensive conversations with him.
Mr. Chalabi's vision for Iraq was instrumental in causing the de-bathification process. But when the Coalition Provisional Authority decided to ease its screening process after unrest of former Iraqi military and Ba'ath Party officials, Chalabi likened it to re-employing the Nazis in Germany. He insisted on a full transfer of sovereignty on June 30th, including Iraqi control over the country's military and finances, a fatal decision in the end.
The flaws in the intelligence are plain enough in hindsight, but any suggestion that pre-war information was distorted, hyped, or fabricated by the leader of the nation is utterly false.
Vice President Dick Cheney and Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld had met with Chalabi days before this statement was made in November of 2005. As for Chalabi himself, as the president-in-waiting in Iraq, former Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz said that was also bunk.
Another myth about Ahmed Chalabi, who was constantly portrayed, is still constantly portrayed as somehow the Karzai of the Pentagon, I suppose you could say, the person the Pentagon wanted to install as the leader of Iraq. But he says correctly, for Donald Rumsfeld, it was a consistent principle that U.S. officials should not try to pick specific leaders for other countries. But state and CIA officials tended not to share this principle. To them, Rumsfeld's insistence that the U.S. government should not discriminate for or against any of the friendly pro-democratic groups was seen merely as camouflage for a campaign to anoint Chalabi.
That's Paul Wolfowitz speaking back in 2008. Ahmed Chalabi eventually went back to his home and, as a skilled political operative, managed to find credibility in the murky world of Iraqi politics, if not success there. He died in the homeland where he was born, living out a reality no doubt very different from his lifelong dreams for Iraq, but pleasant enough, among the palm groves on his large farm in Baghdad. Here's a cultural puzzle for law enforcement. How do you create a way of drawing young people away from extremism and violent radicalization without referencing or offending any of the people or groups young people, the media, and law enforcement associate with radicalism? What would you call such a program? How about Don't Be a Puppet? It's a real name. The FBI came up with it, and the learning tool was scheduled to be released this week, but now that's indefinitely on hold. What could be wrong with puppets? Well, when the completed program was recently shown to community leaders representing Arab, Muslim, and civil rights organizations, they asked that the program be canceled altogether. What does the FBI say? We are, quote, developing a website designed to provide awareness about the dangers of violent extremism, predators on the Internet, with input from students, educators, and community leaders. And that's about all they would tell us, that statement. Abed Ayyub is the legal and policy director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Abed, welcome. And you actually viewed this Don't Be a Puppet program of the FBI's, right?
Thank you for having me on. And yes, I did get an opportunity to review part of the Don't Be a Puppet program.
What was your reaction? What were they trying to achieve? And how, in your view and some of your colleagues' views, do you think they failed?
Well, our initial reaction was surprise, because we were typically, when we work with the any government agency, we're called in at the beginning of a program to offer our advice and expertise on how a program should be developed. This particular meeting, the program was put in front of us and said, here's what we've developed. It's launching. And it seemed that the program as a whole focused on Arab and Muslims, when that's going to stigmatize Arab and Muslim students and cause a problem for many of these students in the schools.
So it didn't refer to Timothy McVeigh, right-wing militia groups, that sort of thing, responsible for the Oklahoma City bombing?
There was a slide with different terror attacks across the world, and it did have Oklahoma City, and it did have Timothy McVeigh. But outside of that slide, I don't recall another portion of the program where it was shown. But the full program as a whole seemed to focus on Arab and Muslims.
The FBI isn't releasing this. They didn't allow us to see any of the slides. Can you give me a sense of the tone of the slides that some of might have found offensive?
The initial homepage, when the student clicks in, it looks like a garage or a workshop, and there's different things they can click on. If you click on the toolbox, it'll say, for example, how to prevent somebody from becoming an extremist, and then it'll have different options. And once you complete each section, there's a puppet that drops down and a string is cut off from the puppet. And ultimately, when you complete all the section, the puppet runs free and you get a certificate. And it says, don't be a puppet. Congratulations. The slides themselves were, again, very problematic. And another thing to keep in mind, there were no slides on what to do if somebody brings a gun to school.
Well, let's turn it around for a second and just try to look. I mean, I can't really attest to the frequency of references to Arabs and Muslims and that sort of thing. It sounds like it was pretty lopsided, at least in your impression and the impression of some other groups. But do you have any sympathy for anyone trying to do something like this who is going to have to somehow refer to familiar groups, characterizations, I don't know, ethnicities, historical events, and deliver information and material that's familiar to young people so that they kind of understand what's going on here? You can't do the whole thing with generic Muppets, right?
The issue we have, one of the main issues we have, is the program itself is creating a dangerous precedent of FBI overreach. And these types of programs, they should be managed by experts, teachers, educators, that create curriculum, that could create the information in the best way for the students. And now we're not saying we agree with the website, but if you are to create material to be taught in classrooms, that's not the FBI's job.
Let me elaborate on that just for a moment, because we've also talked with people on the program who say that, you know, when the FBI is accused of surveillance and intrusive monitoring of mosques and community groups and schools as a way of preventing or being proactive about radicalization of youth, we get the message that, well, you know, the FBI should do something more educational. They should stay away from the community places. Is it sort of hard for the FBI to do anything in this situation? I mean, if they're doing this as opposed to surveillance, isn't that possibly a good thing?
I don't think so. I think the FBI doesn't have a role in this. The CVE, we're talking about here is the CVE program, Countering Violent Extremism. Again, coming through this program through a law enforcement lens is dangerous. You're creating distrust with the community. There's not going to be dialogue and cooperation between the community and the FBI on this program. It's best that the community handle the program, the community work on its CVE measures, and the community address issues when they arise within itself. So that's the important thing to keep in mind. The FBI is imposing these programs and imposing the surveillance when there's really it's really an overreaction. There's really other issues that they could be working on. There's a great focus on Arab and Muslims, and again, what we've seen is that's unwarranted. There's no need to for the FBI to take these measures and implement these programs.
If I'm a teacher or a parent listening to this conversation and want to know from your perspective what's out there that actually does, in your view, seriously and appropriately address the question of radicalization, particularly online radicalization, what would you say are the alternatives to this FBI program if it ever does emerge and see the light of day?
Well, I'll tell you, in the U.S., we have many examples of parents who are able to identify if there is an issue and are able to take action. And within the Muslim community, the mosque and the imam and these community centers play an important role. And across the country, these community centers have been supportive, and they've implemented their own programs to lure children away and lure them away from this path and make sure they know exactly what's wrong with going overseas, what's wrong with going down this path of extremism, and rein them in a little bit. So this is the role and responsibility of the community groups, and that's what we've been seeing.
Abid Ayyoub is the legal and policy director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. He viewed the FBI Don't Be a Puppet educational initiative, which is now indefinitely on hold. Abid, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
What would we call the political party system in America? Is it like a zookeeper for unruly political candidates? Jurassic World for the likes of Trumposaurus, Rubioraptor, or Carcinopteryx.
We should have moderators who are interested in disseminating the information as opposed to, gotcha.
You would think in a debate with CNBC they would talk about things like the economy instead of some of the issues that came up, but anyway.
How do you have a debate on the economy and never mention Obamacare?
Sounds like the Republican National Committee might be having some trouble with some unruly candidates who weren't too happy with those widely watched television debates.
Well, look, there's 14 campaigns, and so, you know, it takes a few people, I guess, to create a narrative. But no, the truth is we're involved, we're in control, we're setting the calendar.
We're setting the calendar, we're in control, says RNC Chairman Reince Priebus on ABC News. Do you feel like maybe we've seen this movie? Case in point, the RNC was not invited to a meeting on Sunday led by several of the presidential campaigns dissatisfied with the way things have gone so far. The CNBC debate fiasco was not calmed by the Republican National Committee's decision to suspend its partnership with NBC News. Reince Priebus assures us that the animals are not running the park, but maybe it's the RNC that's the dinosaur here. Candidates with money, celebrity, and social media don't need anybody between them and the voters anymore. What's the line from Jurassic Park?
I'm simply saying that life finds a way.
Ooh. Jeff Goldblum there. I guess we would say democracy finds a way. Joining me now is Thomas Rath, founder of the firm Rath, Young & Pignatelli and former attorney general of New Hampshire. He served as senior national advisor to the presidential campaigns of Bob Dole, George W. Bush, Mitt Romney, and many others. Thomas Rath, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me. Nice to be here.
So is that a reasonable metaphor? The RNC is trying to marshal and herd some unruly candidates here? Or is it better for the candidates to have unfettered access to voters? What do you think is going on here?
Well, I think the clip you've just played, Jeff Goldblum is explaining what he calls the chaos theory. And I think anybody who tries to eliminate chaos from a presidential selection process probably is ill-advised and better be prepared to accept what you get. It's hard. It's very hard for the party, for the candidates, for the moderators, for the sponsors to create a model situation. And frankly, you don't get to a model situation until you have candidates from each party and you only have two people on the stage and one moderator. This is very, very difficult to do.
Now, we were told, and there's been a lot of reporting on this, that the whole idea here of Reince Priebus and the strategy of the RNC was to try to prevent what happened to Mitt Romney back in 2012, that he got all beat to hell during the primary debates and was therefore a damaged candidate by the time we got to the general. But it's not gone so well. Do you think that's the narrative that's happening here?
I don't know. I mean, Romney was a very strong and enduring front runner. And for all the faults that people now in second-guessing cite to that campaign, he was in the lead when it began. He never lost the lead as a practical matter and was the nominee fairly reasonably early in the process. It's different here. This is a much more wide open circumstance. We've had front runners. Certainly, Governor Bush was a front runner. That didn't last long. Mr. Trump is now, but there's some indication that that's moving. It's a very movable feast right now. I don't know that we have a clear leader. And in that circumstance, when you have the top candidate in the polls at 26, people who are at 3, 4, and 5 are still very, very competitive in this thing, given what can happen when we actually start voting. Part of this is because of the extraordinarily long run-up to actual voter participation. It's just a long, long time from when you announce and when people actually vote. So you rely on things like polls and visibility, and I'm not sure those are necessarily the true test of a candidacy.
Although it seems like we're seeing something different here, and we've just seen it in the House with the fight over the conservative caucus in the House and who's going to be Speaker in the House. It seems like the RNC is trying to paper over a division within the Republican electorate that just can't be papered over anymore. And the candidates emerging here and exploding are just telling us that the RNC is either two parties or it's dead.
Well, I was a member of the RNC for 10 years, and especially when you're out of power, when you don't have the White House, anarchy is the sort of rule of the day.
So you would agree it's anarchy.
I would agree
right
that
now.
It's very. I think you're. First of all, I have a high degree of respect for Reince Priebus and his management of the RNC, as evidenced by the very successful 2014 election cycle. It's hard when you have ego and well-financed folks who are playing by their own rules, and to them, the RNC is a necessary nuisance as opposed to a helpmate, and because the RNC must stay neutral, and I believe it does, you're going to find these stresses and strains. You've got very, very strong-willed individuals who believe, just give me 5 more minutes in front of that camera, and the world's going to fall in love with me. So there is a fight, constant fight for attention.
Some would say that Citizens United is the enabler here of candidates. I mean, it used to be the case in the old days, turn of the 20th century, that the parties, you know, picked the candidates behind closed doors. Powerful, sometimes rich people were responsible for the picking of the candidates. Occasionally an outlier would emerge. Now it seems like the candidates want to do that themselves if they have the money and just muscle the party out of the way. Do you think that's what's going on?
I think then was then and now is now. You're not going to change the rules. You're not going to go back. The more you open up the process, the less disciplined it's going to be. And I think we've seen that over and over again. The opposites of the Democratic Party, where you have a very disciplined front runner who is basically systematically cutting out all opposition. The Republican is much more rambunctious, and I think it's likely to stay so at least through when we finally start voting in February.
But, of course, the Democrats have the White House, which makes the point you were making earlier. Thomas Rath, thanks so much. Fascinating discussion.
Thank you for having me.
Thomas Rath is the founder of the firm Rath, Young & Pignatelli and former Attorney General of New Hampshire. He served as senior national advisor to the presidential campaigns of Bob Dole, George W. Bush, Mitt Romney, and many others. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.